Ladies and gentlemen, this is Clifton Fadiman. The recent death of Fred Allen removed from the American scene far more than a first-flight entertainer. Fred was a kind of cocklebur in the side of the radio and television industry. He loved his trade, which was to make people laugh, but he also understood its absurdities, and indeed, the absurdity of human life in general. He brought to popular entertainment the mind of a satirist, and even something of the perspective of a philosopher. And that was why we all respected him. He was a great craftsman of laughter, but he was also an extremely intelligent man. Conversation was fortunate in persuading Fred from time to time to share his sardonic wit with us. One of these conversations was recorded some time ago, and we present it now for the first time. I think it will bring back to you a man who hated formulas, easy guffaws, and dishonesty. One who left his trade better than he found it. In the conversation which follows, you will hear Fred Allen and our second guest, the distinguished author and critic, Gilbert Seldes. We're talking about how we'd like to live our lives over again.
Tell me, Fred, you feel that the years you spent in building up Fred Allen's show were sort of wasted.
I don't say they're wasted, no. I'm well received at the bank as a result of having spent those years and not spending what the years produced.
Nice to hear that.
But, yes, it's quite a comfortable feeling when you're sitting home in a warm garret. It's something to console you.
It's nice even to hear about somebody who says you've been well received at the bank, Gilbert.
Yes.
I'm looking at you.
Yeah. I'm looking at that.
But I think, of course, in the old days, as far as comedy was concerned and creative people in the theater, a monologist such as I was in the beginning lasted with probably five or six major routines for an entire lifetime. And men like Raymond Hitchcock and Eddie Foy and some of the top Weber and Fields and those sort of people years ago, why in one season of radio, 39 weeks, we would tell more jokes than Weber and Fields probably told in 10 years.
You used yourself up?
No, we didn't use ourselves up because we went along with the times. We were reflecting the times. I mean, if the average comedian would exhaust himself with his little devices, mm-hmm. but we were sort of reflecting the times, so as long as there was any news, we were able to function currently.
Well, Fred, if you had to do the whole thing all over again, would you go into the same business?
Well, I tell you, a great many people far more brilliant than I commented on life, and I've made a little list here, and it wouldn't take too long. I'd just like to give you their impressions. Well, this is 500 B.C.
Oh, it goes way back.
Yes, I start from the beginning. Aristonomus, who was an apprentice philosopher, I think, working under Aristophanes, said that life is a theater in which the worst people often have the best seats. Now, that was 500 B.C., so obviously he wasn't satisfied at that time. Now, in 1759, Samuel Johnson said life is tedious. In 1819, Schopenhauer, the German philosopher, said life, to the great majority, is only a constant struggle for mere existence, with the certainty of losing at last. Nietzsche, in 1874, also a German philosopher, said life is an unprofitable episode that disturbs an otherwise blessed state of non-existence.
I like that.
Hey, well done.
In 1900, Henry James said life is a predicament which precedes death. In 1919, Justice Holmes said all life is an experiment. Every year, if not every day, we have to wager our salvation upon imperfect knowledge. And in 1954, I say, the world is a grindstone and life is your nose. So if these people, not including me, if these people were unhappy with life as they lived it, I'm quite sure that they wouldn't be interested in going through the same experience again.
That may be. You know, it's nice, though, to have yourself backed up by all these names.
Well, of course, I can't produce them on short notice, but I have their word for it, which I'm passing on to you.
It makes you feel part of a privileged society of pessimists.
Past tense society. Passé society.
So I gather that any life you live being so bad, there's not much sense in really starting from scratch and living another life.
Well,
I probably wouldn't improve on it.
I have no desire. I have enough trouble with this life. And I think that when you are, if you live to be 60 or 70 years of age, you finally end up in a rickety chair with the debris of your aspirations tumbled around you, then.
Oh, it's getting too terrible.
Oh, it's awful.
You have a different conception. Of course, this is the humor conception.
Oh, this is the enjoyable conception.
Yes, this is
right,
a happy life.
But suppose you could really live it over again just to suit yourself. Would you be any other kind of person or do any other kind of thing than you have done in the past? Suppose that we made it possible for you to be born in exactly the same year that you were born.
Yeah.
And to choose a different profession or set of professions than you have chosen. Now, Gilbert, you've done a great many different kinds of things. You're an expert on poppy entertainment. In the old days, you were an editor of the Dial, Eyebrow Magazine. You've done half a dozen things. Do you regret having done any of them in the sense that you feel you wasted your time and would rather have filled your time with some other kind of work?
Given the thing to do over again, I think one thing I would do would be to adopt a great many of the, what are called middle-class virtues. For instance, I would save much more money than I did. There was a time when I was rolling in royalties, and I let them roll out again. Mm-hmm. Now, I'd been much better off for the next 10 years and was able to do my own work, the work I wanted most to do, if I hadn't been under pressure to go and make money.
How about you, Fred?
Well, I read this book, the Damon Runyon book, recently, the book that his boy wrote, and in there, Mr. Runyon said something along the same lines as Gilbert here. It says in the book, as I recall, it said, I think my greatest, I'm quoting Mr. Runyon, I think my greatest misfortune was in getting caught in a current that demanded a certain standard of living, and it took money to meet that standard. I would have been better off if I had remained a struggling and obscure fellow of no great means in a small community where I might have found a peace and contentment in plain living and spiritual considerations instead of becoming a big-town byline writer, always fighting to keep up there and to make money.
I think it's also true, Fred, that notable people, as Mr. Runyon was, people who've led, you know, so-called
colorful lives.
Well, it's from the neon light point of view, it was, you know,
Lindy's window.
Yeah, Lindy's window. It looks good. That kind of guy, it seems to me, when you ask him whether he would have wanted to do something else, always says he'd have liked to live in a little small town and lead an obscure life and all that. And I wonder whether there isn't a bit of affectation in that.
Probably when you've arrived at the point in your life when you can't do anything else, you can reflect, and I guess probably that's...
You can afford to be modest in imagination.
You don't regret most of the things you have done.
No.
I'm asking you.
I don't regret most of the things I have done. I've been by many of them, and they haven't been very startling or even credible. But I have noticed one thing about myself. When I ask myself the question, would I like to live my life over again, whenever I try to figure out the kind of life that I would have liked to live over again, it's usually a kind of life absolutely different from that which I'm doing now. For example, I make a living, Gilbert, in the mass communications business, as you know. And I often have thought that I would have liked to have been a scholar. I know I never would have been a very good one. But this is the opposite of the sort of thing I do. In our business, you meet a great many people, and that's a very pleasant thing to do. And yet, when I try to think of changing the base of my life, I often think of that I'd like to be a hermit, which is the exact opposite of the kind of ultra-socialization have to go through in our business. But on the other hand, it isn't true that I would have liked to have been a general or a big business executive, two things which are very remote from any of the things I've tried to do.
You speak of a big hermit. I couldn't think of you in that.
Neither could I, but I have
a social question.
But I have this hankering every once in a while.
Yeah.
Sure. Whenever anyone is dissatisfied with his life, he says, gee, I think I'll go to the opposite extreme.
In a sense,
as it were. Except Fred here, who's going to keep on, of course, being a comedian, aren't you?
I hope so. I don't know whether people coming along in the next generation are going to react to me as long as I last. But I'm going along being a comedian as far as I'm concerned, and the attitude that's toward me is something that I'll have to cope with when it arrives.
Even though there are many dissatisfactions connected with the business, Fred.
Well, as I said, until it became mechanized, those problems weren't available. You see, today, a man who's in the comedy business professionally has to come up with so much material that he reaches so many people in a short time. Years ago, I went to Australia, and I went to Honolulu. I went all over this country about 3 times in different circuits, from the Orpheum circuit right down to the smaller circuit, with one monologue. And doing it twice a day and 3 times a day, I perfected it to the point when I came to New York, I was put in the passing show in 1922. But today, if I have a wonderful routine and sit and think up something, and I do it in one performance, people have stolen it all, and I can't get at them in Omaha, and I don't know that I'm out of business. Each generation makes its own humor. It's like Finley Peter Dunn around the 1900s and 1902 or 3 around there. He was a great force in this country.
Yeah.
And previous to Finley Peter Dunn, Bill Nye, each generation Eli Perkins and the Danbury Newsman, they all entertained their generation, but if you look at the things that they wrote, Josh Billings and those people today, why, they're antiquated and outmoded.
What you're saying is that humor, among all the forms of writing, has the highest mortality rate, then.
Yes, I would say so. Very little of it survives because the next generation comes along and doesn't understand the trolley car jokes, because there aren't any trolley cars in for that generation.
And that's another reason why you think the comedians are on a treadmill to oblivion.
Yes, real good material just becomes obsolete overnight, actually.
Sure.
Or devices that you create or invent are copied and become now in television. They have the situation comedies. Well, there are only supposedly 36 basic situations, and you have a power
well,
that...
Well, four of them being used in television.
Yes,
day.
Used many times every day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I had a quote here, the best substitute for experience is being 16.
That's
just,
I like that. Now, who said that?
Oh, I couldn't tell.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's just written on the back of
the book. Look, I want to fortify it with a little bit of something from Oscar Wilde, which certainly is relevant to what you've been saying, Fred. There's that nowadays most people die of a sort of creeping common sense and discover when it's too late the only things we'll never regret are one's mistakes. I don't believe it, but I think it's...
It's a common notion. The,
yeah.
The things one does regret always are the things one didn't do. Somebody did.
Well,
right?
I don't know. I think if I had to be live again, that I would choose different parents. I would choose wealthy parents who could enable me to get a better education. And then if I could have done it logically, I would have liked to have been a writer, because I have great respect for people who create things out of nothing.
That's what I wanted to get at. So you're really underneath all this, Fred.
I would rather be a writer if I could have survived. But in the early days, of course, our family, we didn't have any great luxuries. I mean, I worked through grammar school. I've heard about fellows working through college. I worked through grammar school and I worked through high school.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got out of high school, then I had to go to work to help the family. And I always regret that I didn't have an opportunity to... to enlarge my education, which would have possibly led to another I would have liked to have been a writer from the beginning. I used to work.
But you are a writer.
Well, I have never been able to support the people or the obligations that I had making
a
living
writing.
Thing.
That's a different thing. You're talking about
being a successful writer. Does this threaten me and ask you? You've been in the prison. You didn't even write in 6 years? Or not?
Well, I wouldn't know. That would depend. That would have depended on the type of education that I got, or the things that happened to me in the process of getting the education.
I don't agree with you.
A good deal of it might have been spoiled by too much education, Fred. Education
is possible.
A passport to good writing at all. It isn't that I want to tell you about yourself, Fred, but my brother.
I don't understand myself. If I can have.
Well, I'll give you 2 minutes here.
The psychiatry,
cheap analysis. You are probably one of the best living letter writers. Now, that is a form of art.
Well, I have no question writing a letter. I enjoy writing letters, and I do it as a sort of a mental exercise.
Yeah, a hobby. But the result is that these letters are of their kind, and I have read many of them, though they weren't all addressed to me, masterpieces. Now, you didn't know that, see?
Well, I enjoy writing letters, but if you ask me to write a piece for a holiday or something like that, then I freeze up and it becomes a great club.
In other words, you're a natural writer rather than a professional writer. Those are two different things.
I was one of the few boys who went in the radio in the early days, the comedians who had been writing, like The Little Show. I wrote all of my things in The Little Show, Feed the Crowd, The Passing Show. Everything I ever did in the theater, I wrote myself on my monologue, so that when radio came along, I was at least equipped to cope with it in a minor way.
Well, you are a writer, then.
Well, I developed in the medium. I was in it for almost 20 years, and we wrote 700 or 800 weeks, 700 or 800 scripts.
Seems to me you've been very lucky, Fred, because not only have you made a great success as a comedian, attained great fame and all that sort of thing, but underneath all this, you've been satisfying your unconscious urge to become a writer by writing letters to the vice president of the National Broadcasting Corporation, or whoever.
Yes, I've written to the president of the Stock Exchange, the mayor of Pottsville. Apologized to him in print at one time.
You lead a really rich epistolary life.
And a literary life, yeah.
I have no copies of any of the letters.
Well, but many people have, though.
Oh, they
circulate, I assure you.
I would willingly edit these for you someday, Fred, when both of us, need to make a living. And
I don't know what I have. My brother died last year, and going up there, he found that for 20-some years he had kept all of the letters that I had written to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have them all in a big box. I don't know what they're about because they go back to, 1920, something like that. Whenever I was going around the country, I feel like that he was ill for many years.
Well, your letters are really interesting. Someone once said, never destroy an uninteresting letter is the first rule of the British aristocracy.
How wonderful.
You know, I've got a formula for living your life over again that is a practical one. When I was about 20, I made up my mind that I would never stay at one job for more than 10 years on the theory that either you were a flop or by the time 10 years are over, or that you'd lift the problems involved in that particular job. Once you'd lift the problems, there wasn't much sense in keeping on with it. And very luckily, I was usually fired around the 10th year of whatever I did.
So they had mastered you rather than...
Well, they knew my formula. And the result was that I've had a chance to work not terribly successfully, but interestingly, at 8 or 9 or 10 different careers, and not, you know, be first flight in any of them. And I chose to do that rather than to stick at one.
Mr. Jern, you are basically an interesting professions. I mean... if you were a plumber and you said, I'll plumb for 10 years and then I'll become a roofer, difficult. But I mean, mentally, there are so few people who sing today. I think that's one of the troubles. We have our standards have gone down in clothing and thinking and comedy and writing and everything else. And everything is on a mass production basis. And I think that the small little group of people who are thinking are keeping the world together.
Well, that's a nice note on which to end that gloomy statement.
Well, one of the things is, of course, you can't take it with you. We accept that, even in no matter which life we lead.
I'll buy
there was one way to deny that. It always irritated me more than anything else, that phrase.
Yeah,
it's better than you think. I hate to.
No, I proved it, because you say you can't take it with you. You've never seen a Brink truck in a funeral procession. If you saw the Brink truck after the hearse, then you would know you were taking it with you.
But the funny thing is that people insist on trying to take an awful lot with them, even though they know the truth of the statement.
Well, I think it's satisfying at the time, and I think that's all you do. You have your urges and your emotions from day by day, from hour by hour. And
does anyone ever really start afresh? Actually, it's not difficult for some human beings to start a new career in their mid-20s or mid-30s. Sometimes they make a great deal of money, and they're absolutely free to do an entire...
There's another way. It's a very good way. It's used only in daytime serials. Amnesia. The minute a man gets amnesia, he marries a second time. That's as if, you see, the theory is, if he loses his mind, he gets married. This, I don't approve of, as a theory. But
usually the other way around.
Yeah.
You lose your mind as a result of getting married, I think.
But amnesia is a way. You do start fresh. So tell me.
Well, many refugees are forced to start new lives, and they become very successful in other countries. And
but doesn't that seem to indicate that maybe it's a good idea to start from scratch every once in a while?
By people who
believe in that.
And came here, and I don't mean only the original colonists, but every immigrant came here, said, I will take a chance, and I will start again.
But how many people who, let us say, are quite successful at the age of 30, and in this country you can be quite successful at that age, really... sum it up and start a new slate.
Well, sure. If you're a tycoon at 33, you certainly can't un-tycoon yourself.
Well, that's it. In other words, you don't really have free will.
You can, but you won't.
The notion of being successful, or the advantage of being successful, is that you're supposed to be freer in your choices if you're successful.
Mm.
But actually, the successful business tycoon of 33 is, as you say, so enmeshed in the business that he has created that he has no free will whatsoever. And actually, it's the chap who is a clerk, perhaps, in the same business who can make more fundamental choices than the man at the head.
I don't think that you can live your life the way you plan it, because there are too many forces rampant against you in life, too many other things that work against your desire.
Well, thank goodness, I say, because I think most of it, I'm true myself, I think about any plan I've laid out, I must have just about the age of getting in and getting out of college. I think we all have a sort of a plan. I'll bet your mind would have been a dreadful, tedious plan.
I said, what got you into the invotable in the old days?
Well,
money, actually.
Yes, you might have made money doing something else. We all have money.
At that time, money was very important. And I used to work in the library in Boston at 20 cents an hour.
Did you work in the library? You're old and ex-librarian.
In Boston? Not in Boston.
In New York?
I got 50 cents an hour in Pittsburgh.
We got 20 cents an hour in Boston. You see the scale at that.
Yeah. Oh, Boston's a much more conservative town that way.
Then you had Keith Vaudeville around the corner, didn't you?
Yes, Keith started that, actually, in a store on Washington Street.
Well, but how did you go downhill from being a librarian to being a vaudeville comedian?
Well, because I went uphill financially with the same message. Yeah, I defied gravity there for a while. I had 20 cents an hour, 60 cents an hour from 6 to 9 after school in the library. And by that time, I was hungry. When I got out at 9 o'clock, I had to spend 10 cents of my 60 cents for milk and a sandwich.
But wasn't that extravagant, Fred?
It was at that time, but I found out that amateur nights, you could go on amateur nights and get a dollar. So that was a lot of fun going around to the different neighborhoods, appearing as a juggler. And
is that how you began as a juggler? Mm-hmm. How'd you learn juggling?
As a hobby. We moved in another neighborhood, and I didn't know any of the kids around, and I had to work after school, so... how I took it up, I'll never tell you.
But and you became a juggler, and you won dollar bills or something at the amateur
The library put on a show for the employees, and I appeared as a juggler. And everybody said, "You're crazy to be here. You ought to be on the stage." And if I could locate those people today, I'd certainly bring them to court.
Right, we wouldn't. We would thank you, Phil.
But it was
really
an accident, man. But how did you...
No, it was just a matter of 40 cents a night.
How did you know you were funny?
Well, my father was funny, you know, in an amateur way. He was just funny. My brother was funny, too, before, up until the time he was quite ill. And the whole family, my father's side, all his brothers were sort of Irish part-time witch, you know. And they were funny around the bookbinding. They worked in the bookbinding place over in Cambridge there. And they're all, you know...
You think you came by it naturally, then?
I would think so. The basis of it must be someplace in our family. But I was the only one. Nobody ever went into the theater except in the front door, and very many times they couldn't afford to go in the front door either. But that's how I started. It was a question of 40 cents a night and having a lot of fun instead of working up in the stacks there for 60 cents.
That's the old economic motive.
It certainly was, even in those days.
Still is, for that matter, I suppose.
Yes, it is, except the incentive is dulled, is blunted a little now with the tax problem.
Do you feel that the sort of thing you did during the heyday of the Fred Allen Show, Fred, couldn't be done today? So much of that humor seemed to me to be pretty subtle stuff, full of irony and satire. But
I couldn't do it visually. That was written for that particular medium, and it worked out well in the medium because the medium is reduced to the words in the ear, the intimacy of the ear and the word. But you couldn't use that type. It's too subtle, I would think, for television.
Would you get away with the Claghorn now? I'm thinking now of regardless of the passage, do it.
Well, of course, that depends on current issues, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We always had that. We had the Russian things that had to be eliminated.
Would you get away with dialect humor in general?
Not visually, I don't think. Unless it was an honest...
But how about Mr. Nussbaum?
That was always an honest character.
She was. Oh, great character.
We never had any mail on all of the commotion there when things were going against the dialect comedy. We never had any mail against her at all because she never said or did anything that was could be construed in any way except being in the woman that she
was. Why do you think the kind of comedy that you did in those days isn't being done on radio today?
Well,
I don't see much sign of it.
Well, primarily because, unfortunately, these media, the radio and television, are totally dependent on advertising. And the minute that the audience went to television, then you find out that you have a shrinkage in the mass audience available for the advertiser in radio.
I find with regret, though, that those the kind of humor that you did is just not anywhere to be found on the air.
We were the only ones doing it then, actually, because nobody talked about the current issues or the political things as far as you could go, or the news of the day. We commented on that always.
Yeah, always in a very light way, though.
You couldn't because the sponsor was involved, the network was involved in the early days.
Suppose, speaking of living your life over again, suppose television could live its life over again. It has a 20-year-old life now, something like that?
But
there are some mistakes that perhaps it has made that it would correct?
I think there's too much material required, you know, for commercial purposes. And I also think that in the theater you survive if you do good things. If you do poor things, you don't. You're not in business. But in the television and in radio, because you're subsidized by the advertisers, you can survive and still be have a very low standard and still be popular and be profitable for their purposes.
What could it do to advance the art of comedy that you advanced so well on radio.
Well, I don't think that you could help anything when it's subsidized by advertising money, because then it becomes a highly competitive business, same as...
Can't agree there.
The conversation has just brought you a transcribed program dedicated to Fred Allen. Sometime before his death, Fred Allen recorded a conversation with Clifton Fadiman and Gilbert Seldes on the subject, How I'd Like to Live My Life Over Again. This program is a tribute to the memory of Fred Allen, one of America's greatest talents in wit, humor, and comedy. Next week at this same time, Clifton Fadiman will record another transatlantic program through the courtesy of the British Broadcasting Corporation. His guest on the other side of the Atlantic will be Sir George Thompson, author of The Foreseeable Future. Mr. Fadiman and Jock Barzin will discuss some of the possibilities of the future of our civilization based on Sir George's book. Conversation is a Lewis G. Cowan production in association with the National Broadcasting Company. Directed by Bob Maurer. The producer was Polly Collins. This is Jack Costello inviting you to join us next week at this same time for more good conversation. This has been an NBC Radio Network production.
Blizzard or fair weather, spring is officially here, and to usher in the new season, NBC's monitor takes in activities all over the globe. At home, spring means baseball training, and you'll hear interviews with Robin Roberts of the Philadelphia Phillies, Bob Feller of the Cleveland Indians, and many others. Then, spanning the oceans, it's the Grand National Sweepstakes race at Aintree, England, and the Oxford-Cambridge Crew Race in London. Later, you're off to the big international trade fair at Leipzig, Germany, and you'll eavesdrop on two special interviews with Prince Rainier of Monaco, including a trip to Seattle, where residents are planning to give the prince and his future bride a replica of Mount Rainier, Washington. More celebrities talk to you from monitor microphones. Sammy Kaye, Betty Grable, Jerry Lewis, Captain Cornell, and Phil Harris are just a few. While for top dramatic entertainment, hear the new Monitor World Theater, bringing you top stars from every country. It's all on NBC's Monitor this weekend. You are the company Weekday likes to keep on NBC Radio.